System decided to split up the three panels, which is really a portrait of Freud, left, center, and right side. And it ends up in three different hands. Mm. Now, it goes along for a while. Parts of it get exhibited as single panels or double panels. And then a collector in Italy decides to reunite the picture and takes about 10 years to get all three parts back together.
Wow.
And so you can finally see it the way Freud created it. But of course, given the size of his studio, not the way he saw it initially.
Right. So Francis Bacon had a kind of a small and very messy studio.
That's generous.
Unorganized. Really. And we should note that the studio itself is so famous that it was taken apart piece by piece and brought to Ireland, I believe. Yes.
Yes.
Because he's originally from there.
He was born of English parents in Dublin, and the studio now lives in Dublin. They literally had a team of three archaeologists, professional archaeologists, to dig down through the studio. Each layer,
right.
Each thing. But what they found was a series of interesting things, including one of the photographs that's a source for this painting.
So are we saying then that did Bacon take photographs of people that he was, or is this another kind of a source? Because I know he sometimes used a found a source, you know, and he'd tack something on the wall that came from a paper or whatever.
Oh, yeah, Eva. He would use movie posters. He would use newspaper photos. He would find an image of Kafka that he liked, and he'd rip it out of the magazine, take it. You never wanted him to go to your dentist office before you because the magazine would be a wreck. But he'd take these things. What he did in the 60s is he had, for a number of reasons, found this triptych format, and he decided that he was going to make a series of portraits of his close friends and associates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he and Lucian Freud, who met in 1946, 45, were gambling and drinking buddies. They argued art nightly almost for 25 years.
In Soho mostly.
In the bars of Soho and the gambling club. So, you know, he was one of the subjects. He hires John Deacom, who was, one of the profligate artists of the area.
Oh, okay.
He was one of the guys they would see every night at the roulette table or something. I made that up. But in that social milieu, to take portraits, photographs of a list of friends.
Yes.
And then those became the raw material for this series of paintings that he does from about the mid-60s until the mid-70s.
So one thing Bacon is doing is he's really documenting his time and his milieu, but he's has the voice that no one else has.
No, that's right.
Right?
Absolutely.
And, one thing I just want to, getting to the paintings that are at the Art Museum, I was blown away. It was, for me, it was sort of an earth-shattering experience, and I don't know if that's because I'm not seeing enough great art, or are those paintings that great?
They're really amazing.
They're that great.
They're that great. People have had that kind of experience happily and reported it a number of times. I saw the paintings in 1999 in the show at the Tate, and I remembered them from that. And then when they turned up at auction, it was like, oh, my God, those paintings. It's the best portrait he makes of Lucian Freud. Bacon did probably close to a dozen, 20 images of Freud, sometimes just the head as a study.
Yeah.
He did two sets of triptychs of Freud. This is the best.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about this combination of that strangely abstract kind of obliquely two-color background and then this figure, all this energy tied up. I mean, did you feel the kind of torque tension. And the tension?
Yes. Well, I'm amazed at how still in one way it is and yet so active in another way. He's able to have both at the same time. And that's what I think creates that tension.
That's an interesting notion because I agree with you. I think that there's something about the format, you know, traditional religious format.
Mm-hmm.
You know, usually he, she, and it are in the middle, and then the saints and the sponsors on the side,
right.
You know, so setting up an event. Here the picture is static, But by the way he's pushed the figure of Freud in the left and right panels to those edges.
Yes.
And then the center picture doesn't have Freud in the middle. He's somehow twisted slightly and to the right. And so suddenly you feel this dynamic, the tension between the left and center panel is increasingly charged because of this space that opens up between the two views of the artist.
Mm-hmm. And the way he's using this sort of cage device.
Ah, yes, the space frame.
The space frame. So for me, that originates, is this true in the Eichmann trials and does it originate in some way from seeing these Nazis behind a glass or in a cage of some sort?
I think that's really interesting because we know that he had photographs from the Berlin trials,
right.
And those guys were inside this kind of cage, and that resonated certainly for Bacon. But he appropriates that, and it becomes both a cage, and it's like a crystalline form.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like the studio we're sitting in which one of the corners has been chopped into a big triangle.
Yes.
You know, and reshaped. It's sort of a reshaping of the space, because otherwise it would be a yellow and green, and it would be very flat. But
yes.
That space frame suddenly pulls the energy toward the head, pulls the energy down into the body.
Yes.
Because of the linear structure that the cage does. Where at the trials of the Nazi, it's containing this force of evil.
Yes.
You know, and you get that sense of its purposefulness. With Freud, because of the way Bacon lifts the top of the space frame into that crystal shape, that kind of peaking arc, it's as if it is opening toward us. You know, remember how it kind of pulls back behind him?
Uh-huh.
And so suddenly it's as if the figure bursts, pushes out against the edges of that frame.
Well, is that also a reference to a bed?
Yes.
A brass bed? And this is also a reference to the fact that that Lucian Freud was an abundant ladies' man.
14 children we know and
yes.
still counting.
Wow.
You know, yes. And it also, because the photographs were taken, and Bacon, who never used a sitter, he preferred the neutral space of the empty studio with the image of the subject, not the person.
Right.
The photograph records the studio bed that Freud famously used for some of his portraits of people. You know, I wanted to show this picture in the worst way because here are two of the great figurative artists of the 20th century, both of them diametrically opposite in the way they approached their subjects and what they called in an interesting way out of their subjects. You know, you and I talked earlier about how emotionally charged and you know, psychological Bacon can be.
Yes.
But Freud is so physical. You know, he looms over his model. He stands up paint.
He's right on them.
He's right on them.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, if they weren't already naked, the way he stares at them, he strips away the artifice until he sees every blush, every nuance of color on the skin, and he names it. You know, creative people, artists often name the color. What am I seeing? What color am I seeing? I'm seeing coral.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we
and
do this.
You do that.
Yes.
You know, and it's something the viewer doesn't understand, but we physically can experience both in Bacon and Freud, but certainly in Freud's paintings, where he makes tangible and nameable the color of the top of a hand.
Yes.
The differentiation of tone.
Well, you know, speaking about color a little bit, so I felt like those paintings, the Bacons, the yellow, gold, and then this kind of green, there's part of it that is so flat, but then there's another part of it sort of like active underneath. And I just felt like this sounds strange, but he nailed the 60s, but in a way that we often don't see. like he's got another kind of 60s, if you know what I'm saying. But I remember those kinds of paintings, not done as well as him. But I'm just saying, my mom was an artist in the 60s, and this kind of flat, but not flat, this sort of, and that yellow especially.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
So intense.
Yes.
You know, and I think the interesting thing for me that I thought about, but I never really focused on until this round, is how flat and matte and uniform that background is. That background's put on at the end.
Think
you
so?
Know, yeah. No, oh. He talks about it. And you can see as you look at it, if you look where the yellow intersects the space frame,
yeah,
it's like this quivering zone, no man's zone. Not unlike the Frank Stella's stripe paintings,
right,
where he draws a pencil line, uh-huh, and then he paints the two colors up to but not on top of the pencil line.
Yes.
So there's this little furry bit.
That he does have that. You're right.
And so what Bacon talks about is, because of his process being both totally controlled and expressionist at the same time, he repaints the background at the last minute.
Because he's a little messy, though, right?
Correct.
Because he's a messy through the whole thing and kind of almost hitting the canvas sometimes. Yep. And so that background has to be added at the end.
Yeah. So he reestablishes it. But the difference, and you know, it's that quality between that golden yellow and that earth-infused, brown-infused green. It's the modeling. It's like this, you know, the light off a bad shag carpeting somehow. But it is this otherness of that oval base plate where the figure stands and sits. I think it's really an interesting background. You know, he's painting on raw canvas.
Right. That gives part of the furry, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because the paint's sinking in.
Right, right.
It's also, the background colors are not oil paint. They're...
Is it an acrylic?
Acrylic and distemper.
That's why it gives it that 60s feel as well.
It's right, that surface is right there.
But what about the figure?
The figure is oil paint.
That's why it's coming out and it's more luminous.
Yes. The luminosity is the thing.
That's it.
You know, and the way he can drag that brush on the figure across the surface of the canvas and just leave a scatter shot of vermilion red over lavender with white underneath it on the figure's face is because it's oil, and part of it will be translucent and part of it is opaque.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the background feels totally opaque.
Yes.
Uniform matte. And Bacon sort of got to this point because I think he wanted the figure as an emotional and a physical fact to separate itself from the background.
But I think also just being a practical artist here, he could make all those moves on the face and all that action. You can do that with oil paint because you can work it a long time. And it's, whereas the background, it's going to be more of a, I don't think you need those things, the kind of painting that he's doing.
No.
You know?
No, that's right. You know, because he wants us to experience something that's emotional and psychological with the sitter. And he doesn't care about the background. The background is a device
to make
keep
you look.
Pulling you and make you look and focus you in. Now, Freud, on the other hand, the sheets under one of his nude women or men will be as active a surface as the body.
Uh-huh.
It's as if he's trying to touch every square inch,
mm-hmm,
and feel and transfer for us in the physical reality of the painting what it means to touch.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. My name is Ava Lake, and this is Art Focus. If you want more information about this radio show, you can go to kboo.fm/artfocus, and you can see more information about my guests and links to past interviews. I've been here about 5 years, and almost everything is online. Right now, I'm talking with Bruce Gunther of the Portland Art Museum, and we're talking about a painting in three parts, a triptych by Francis Bacon that is at the museum right now, and it's a portrait of Lucian Freud. Now, we had talked earlier that he had painted Freud several times, but this work is kind of the accumulation of all of that, yes? The crescendo.
This is the crescendo. It's the penultimate version of Freud. In it, you know, it's as if he hits a home run exactly on mark. We put a photo of Bacon and Freud in the gallery with it, so you could see the physical information about what Freud looked like. But what he got there in the painting that he didn't have consistently in the other portraits he did was this wriggling, wiggling, kind of antsy physicality of Freud. His hands in the painting are appearing and disappearing. It's as if he's, you know, just kind
of barely holding on. Yes.
You know?
But was he as crazy as Francis Bacon, though?
They were different crazy.
They were, I'm just, yeah, Sam, you know, there's a self-portrait going on there as well in some way.
Of course.
Francis Bacon's world, let's put it that way.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, because Bacon, he's working with a photograph, a black and white photograph of Lucian Freud. He can fold it, he can tear it, he can reassemble it. But basically, when he goes to the canvas, he's pushing Bacon at Freud. These guys argued about the nature of figuration. Should it be fact or fiction? Should it be emotion or reality? And what he does is he creates his emotional response to Freud. Bacon is an unapologetic gay man. He lived his life openly and raucously.
Yes.
His friend and fellow traveler, Freud, an unapologetic womanizer and heterosexual, their worlds came together at night through art, drink, and talking. They shared their we know from their diaries and the friends around them, they shared their emotional traumas. You know, this woman leaving, this boy appearing, you know, cruising
kind of
the clubs.
Unusual relationship at that time.
Absolutely.
I mean, even...
Unusual. It would be unusual today.
Yes, that to be that close, that intimate. Now, didn't he, Bacon, did he paint when he came home drunk, or did he paint in the morning and kind of sweating it out? I know he had sort of a routine.
He had a routine. Yeah, and you're right about the off-gassing. You know, that kind of, I've been drinking too much all night. And then, you know, by the time he gets to the studio, it's ritualized. Both of them were kind of ritualized. There's a kind of a lunch, there's a work, there's an afternoon. They paint, they come back, and sometimes Bacon would attack the cameras after a club. I mean, you know, it's that motivation. The studio is always available. And unlike Freud, who had to paint from a model, who never painted from photographs, you had to be in the room to be painted by Freud.
Right.
Bacon could walk in at 1 in the morning or 3 in the morning and destroy a picture or find a painting.
I remember somebody telling me, this was years ago, that Andy Warhol reinvented portraiture for the 20th century. But actually, Bacon did that too, but in another way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think what Bacon, you know, that's interesting because I do believe Andy reinvented it.
He reinvented
it through, I think, through as much through his technology, his embracing of silkscreen.
Yes.
And its flatness and its segmenting of the face into a series of signifiers, the helmet hair, you know,
the grid.
Lips, the grid. Yeah.
Multiple
image portrait. You know, whereas Bacon is truly our existential painter.
Yes, it's a human condition.
That human condition.
Yes.
And it's a human condition that is about a response to the idea and the personality. What makes this Freud portrait so successful is Bacon crystallizes his caring for this rogue, this scallywag, who is his closest friend.
Right.
And he captures it in the way the head twists, the nose, the kind of, you know, intensity of the eyes. I ran across a photo of Freud the other day, and he had these piercing black eyes. And when you look at that right side of the triptych, those eyes are like, you know, you don't know, is he confronting me? Mm-hmm. Yeah, 'cause there's this emotional kind of riveting of these very dark, sinking eyes with this kind of flurry of paint around them. You know, mm-hmm. it's as if suddenly he opens the eye and he pins you to the wall.
So I read somewhere that he really didn't make that many paintings. Is that true? I mean, that was one of the reasons that this the price of these paintings skyrocketed as they did. There's not that many Bacons around. It seems to me, I thought he was prolific.
Well, I think of him as a prolific artist. I think the triptychs, there are very few triptychs.
All right.
There have been very few on the market. There have been some of the triptych studies. He would do small, because Bacon didn't draw a lot. He worked right on the canvas with his brush. He didn't make preliminary sketches the way Freud would do or many artists do. He'd go right to the canvas, begin drawing, and you see in this canvas places where he changed his mind. He repainted it, took it out.
Mm-hmm.
The triptychs don't come on the market, and they're once they go into a collection, that's it. They
yes.
don't come out. It's rare for a picture like this to come out. It was reassembled by this Italian collector. He kept it off view for 15 years, and suddenly, well, it was time to sell.
So on Facebook, I think it was Mark Willey who said, would anyone care if this painting had only gone for $14 million or something like that? And then I believe it was Jeff Yahn who said, yes, it would. It's that good. So I actually agree with Jeff. What say you?
Well, I saw Mark in the galleries on Sunday.
Okay.
He finally came by to see it.
Uh-huh.
Rather than just commenting.
Yes, because I think that comment came before
yes,
Sunday.
Yes, before Sunday.
Oh, okay.
I think you do care. The price is a factor. You know, you couldn't buy that picture for $14 million today because that's what Bacon's cost 20 years ago.
Right. Yes.
You know, single canvases are selling for $35 to $50 million.
Uh-huh.
If you do the math, it's not a bad deal. You have one of the great figurative expressionist artists painting one of the great kind of realist figurative artists of the English scene, and they're doing it at the peak of their experience.
Yes, it's a collaboration in a way.
In a way, it's a collaboration.
Yeah, you're not just getting the one artist, really.
No, because, you know, it's when you work figuratively, it's that relationship you establish with the model, with the subject.
Mm-hmm.
For Bacon, he wanted an arm's length. Is this the not-so-closeted, never-closeted gay man looking back and saying, I hold the world at arm's length, and I use the mediation of photography to allow me to focus on my feelings about
right.
it?
Uh-huh.
Whereas Freud wants to experience the flesh. And so to have the intellectual expressionist painting the misogynist realist is very, I love this irony.
So was it Bacon that said, the point of the artist is to deepen the mystery? Is that the quote? Or point of art?
The point of art, yes.
Or maybe the job of the artist.
The job of the artist.
The job of the artist is to deepen the mystery. So for me, part of that is that distance that's there. And maybe he asks more questions than he answers anything.
I think there's something in Bacon that's absolutely true. You know, he's gone through a whole series of thematic series before these portraits. He's come to a point in his life where he looks into his own life instead of out at art history.
Yeah.
He's trying to make sense and to complicate something that's very private. And that always is a series of questions. We ask questions about the questions he posed in making the work. So it's this kind of like using a photograph instead of the person. You set up a series of things that cause you to pause, that causes you to a simple idea to be deflected to more complex experience.
Also, something we haven't really talked about here is that they're both these figurative painters in the 1960s kind of going against the grain. I mean, look what's happening in the United States at the time.
Oh, and in England.
Yeah.
You know, the generation of abstractionists around Bridget Riley, Henry Moore,
or things like
Ben
Nicholson. Richard Hamilton and pop art.
Pop art.
Mm-hmm.
All those things are happening. And here are two guys who say, no, the artist has to reflect the human condition. The artist has to break down this essential space between the other and the self. between the idea and the figure. And they're against the grain. That's why they, I think they're drawn intellectually to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Equally powerful, equally engaged, both outsiders as painters and as people.
And they had to fight for that position, I think, to be a figurative painter at that time. You had to defend it. Right. And they both were sort of feisty enough that they, you know, I imagine that's something that they had in their relationship was not only just talking about it, but defending that choice and that practice.
Yes, I agree completely. Absolutely.
Well, Bruce, I got to wrap this up. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Always a pleasure. And, you know, you and I both knew we'd have to talk about this. We
yes.
both love Bacon.
Yes, I love Francis Bacon very much. I have read The Gilded Gutter Life and I love the movie Love is the Devil. Loved yes. that film as well.
It's on Netflix. You can...
Really? Well, I'm going to wrap this up. My name is Ava Lake. You've been listening to Art Focus. Today I had Bruce Gunther with me from the Portland Art Museum, and we talked about the Francis Bacon paintings, which are part of the Masterworks series, right? So this is, I mean, we've got like 1 minute left. Tell us, what does that mean? Visiting great paintings?
Yeah, visiting great paintings. We've done Raphael, Titian, Moran, and now Bacon. We have a 10-year commitment to bringing world masterpieces to Portland for us to spend 3 months looking and thinking and feeling.
That's another one of the successes, I think, of this particular show, because you got in that room just those three paintings, and that really made it all the better to just have that donated that yeah. space for that.
Yeah, the designated space, use focus, you think you can come back because 3 months is enough time. I want to go back and look at that
painting
again.
I am going to go back. Yeah, I'm going to go back. All right, so you're listening to Art Focus again. My name is Ava, and I won't be back for a couple of weeks. I've been sharing this show with Joseph Galavan. He's been helping me out, and he'll be your host next week. I'll be talking with you in a couple of weeks.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 2014 Martin Luther King Breakfast on Monday, January 20th at 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast MLK Boulevard in Portland. Each year, the Scanner organizes an inspiring presentation honoring the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and highlights the good work of people making a difference in the community. This year's keynote speaker is Dr. Bruce Goldberg, Oregon Health Authority Director. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's Martin Luther King Breakfast on January 20th, 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center. More information can be found at kabu.fm/MLK Breakfast 2014.
Such large numbers. KBOO Radio is proud to sponsor Keep Alive the Dream 2014, the 29th annual tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This annual event, a production of World Arts Foundation Incorporated, will be broadcast live from the Anthem Convention Center at 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in its entirety on KBOO on Monday, January 20th from 11 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side under Community Events.
It's hard to think this great man is dead.
I give.